The following presentation was featured at the 17th Annual National Jewish Retreat in Palm Desert, California, a project of the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. We hope you enjoy it. We encourage you to visit jretreat.com for information on upcoming retreats. The Aleph of Happiness by members of the Sinai Scholars Society, Brenna Barnholtz, Noah Bukris, and Avin Kreisler.
Hey everyone, my name is Avin Kreisler. I'm a recent graduate of Arizona State University and a passionate, aspiring doctor. If you weren't before, by now you may be familiar with Sinai Scholars, which focuses on the Rebbe's advocacy of learn Aleph, share Aleph. This concept highlights the responsibility of anyone possessing knowledge to share it with others, emphasizing that leadership and teaching roles are not exclusive to rabbis and rebbetzins. This past year, JLI, Sinai Scholars, and myself were able to really embody the idea of learn Aleph, share Aleph through a novel branch of Sinai Scholars called the Vayakri Initiative. JLI drafted four unique standalone classes. The content organized in a way for students to easily understand and prepare content while balancing the rigors of school. This pilot semester not only gave us invaluable information for the future growth of this program, but was also extremely successful. I taught on my campus four unique lessons through seven different one-hour sessions. I engaged in an interactive discussion with 20 or so of my friends while eating delicious kosher snacks. Across six different campuses in the United States, Arizona State, University of South Carolina, Penn State, Binghamton, Cal Poly SLO, and Cal State Northridge, seven Vayakri leaders and over 50 students engaged in Torah learning during their free time with their friends and were a true embodiment of the Rebbe's message to learn Aleph, share Aleph. Myself and these two leaders, Noah Bukris and Brenna Barnholtz, are going to give you all a direct insight into what's happening on our campuses today because of Vayakri and because of Sinai Scholars. Before we begin our session, we'll now take a few moments to get to know these exemplary student teachers and learn a little bit about their unique experience being of the first students to ever teach on campus, taking Sinai Scholars to the next level.
Hi. I'm Brenna Barnholtz, a recent graduate from California Polytechnic State University of San Luis Obispo, where I majored in sociology and law. I taught two classes, both being on the topic of how to buy happiness, on my campus this past year to students. I was nervous teaching the class at first because I wondered if I had any sort of credibility to my fellow students. But after teaching the class and hearing the feedback from my friends, I was surprised in the best way possible. One of my friends, who isn't super involved in the Jewish community, attended and texted me multiple times asking when we'll have the other class and even mentioning the practices he was now doing as a result of this class. I hope that you all here today also get something practical out of this course to apply to your everyday lives.
Hi everyone, my name is Noah Bukris. I just graduated from California State University, Northridge. And I'm starting my master's program at the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing in about 2 weeks, so super excited. So at Chabad of Season, I taught the How to Buy Happiness course a few times, as well as the class of the Saga of Ruth right before Shavuot. I really enjoy taking the lesson plan and learning about it, learning with my rabbi, and kind of taking everything that I learned and making a unique spin to make teaching and learning with my friends fun on campus. I had about 20-ish of my friends come to every single one of my classes, and my favorite part was a few weeks later, one of my really good friends texted me, and she told me about all the different things that she learned from this course and how she's applying it to her everyday life, and she could see actual differences.
During our session today, we'll delve into the most popular Vayakri JLI course, How to Buy Happiness. This course explores Judaism's practical solutions for cultivating positive emotions and resilience. Noah, Brenna, and I will each be teaching a portion of the cumulative lesson, the same class that we taught all of our peers on our own campuses. We are so excited to to share these valuable teachings with all of you. Thank you all for joining us. Let's begin. The challenge is well known that despite the relative affluence in today's society, especially here in America, too many people are unhappy. And this indicates that our circumstances like our health, our prosperity, our income, our education, our location, these things themselves are not defining factors that fuel our happiness. So then the question becomes obvious. What then is the crucial ingredient to living happily? And I want you all to think, what makes you happy? I want to take this moment to perform a little exercise before we begin. I want everyone to, you can either pull out your phone or you can think in your brain. Think of the five most things that you appreciate, from the most important to least, only five. And we'll revisit that a little bit later. But again, throughout this lesson, I want you to focus on the question, what makes you happy, and let that guide you throughout this experience. So the question is, why are people unhappy? The Zohar, the classic work of esoteric Jewish mysticism, points out something really interesting. It says the letters forming the Hebrew words besimcha, or with joy, are the same letters that spell machshava, or thought. So from this we can see that there's a connection between joy and our thoughts. Instead of joy being associated with your circumstances, meaning how much money you make, what school you're in, you know, the location you live in, it should actually be associated with our thoughts, the way we think about those actual circumstances. The answer to I can be happier if A, B, or C shouldn't revolve around if I had higher grades, if I had more money, if I had a better car, but it should revolve around our thought processes and attitudes to our own reality. In terms of genetics, studies show that genes actually have an impact on one's happiness. Yet modern psychology assumes that everyone can learn to live happier. So how can these two points coincide? According to the current understanding, everyone has a genetic set range of happiness, but people often aren't living in the highest degree of that range. And so that's what we believe we can change. Indeed, most people, they don't have the ability to make significant changes to their life circumstances. So therefore, if it were true that a better education, a warmer climate, a higher income are the most crucial keys to happiness, then that would mean that people would not be able to be happy or enhance their emotional lives in any way. How many of us can choose to relocate to Hawaii? How many of us can just make more money? You might be thinking, yes, I can. I physically could relocate to Hawaii. I'll sell my house. I'll buy a ticket. I'll go there. I'll bring my stuff with me. I'll move into an apartment. Maybe someone's thinking, yes, I can make more income. I'll work double shifts and I'll get two jobs. You can do all of those things. But the question you want to ask yourself is, what is the cost? If you move to Hawaii, you most likely won't have all the friends that you were with before. You may have different resources. Anytime you have to go visit family, the ticket's like $1 billion. And let's say you decide to, you know, work double shifts, make more money, you know, just work. Do you really think that that's going to make you happier? You're right, you'll have more income, but you'll be spending more time working and doing and spending less time doing the things that you actually enjoy and being around the people that you want to be with. On the other hand, our mind can be in our control. And the best part is that it's at no cost. The most crucial key to our happiness, our mind, is something that we can regulate and modify. We therefore need to explore what types of thinking patterns we can adopt to introduce more joy into our lives. I want to pose another question. Why is it that having more stuff doesn't automatically result in more happiness? Now, before I said, oh, if you work more, then it's a cost, or if you move here, then it's a cost. But it's bigger than just the cost. The following passage of the Midrash alludes to an answer. This Midrash is Kohelet Rabbah, chapter 1, and it says, we don't manage to leave this world with even half of our desires fulfilled. When we have 100, we want to turn it into 200. When we have 200, we want to turn it into 400. What does that mean? Does it mean I just want more and more? Yeah, seemingly, but there's actually a deeper understanding to this that can really show us the root of the problem. When we earn something novel and special and new, it feels good for a while. But after a certain amount of time, those positive emotions tend to wane and they tend to balance out. So what happens then to feel happy again? We feel compelled to seek out something else that's new. Psychologists call this term adaptation. A very simple example would be when you walk into a pool, you're cold for the first few seconds, but then the body adapts, and soon enough, you don't feel the cold of that water. Much of human emotion works the same way. We experience an emotional spike of joy when we get something new, but then it just becomes normal. And when something is normal, it ceases to cause happiness. Now that's very interesting. Imagine that you got a brand new coffee machine. This coffee machine made your coffee in a fifth of the time that you'd make it normally, and the coffee was 10 times better. For those of you coffee lovers out there, I'm sure that if you woke up and you had that new coffee machine, you would appreciate it, your day would be off to a better start, you'd be happy every time you put that cartridge in, click the button, and just watch the magic happen. But after a certain amount of time, it would then not give you the same happiness. So what happened to the coffee machine? It has the same intrinsic value. The only thing that changed was the way that you viewed it and the way that you labeled it normal. So what we see here is that normality and happiness are mutually exclusive. So what happens then? When we have this pattern, we seek out more and more and more and more, and the cycle never ends. But the human nature to adapt is not actually a bad thing. It can be positive when it helps us recover from a saddening or traumatic event. When, God forbid, when something terrible happens, you think it's the end of the world right then. And no matter how bad, I guarantee you that a week later, it won't be as bad. Or even a couple moments later, depending on the magnitude of what happened. And then, because of this ability to adapt and for our emotions to normalize, we're then able to look at those circumstances and those experiences and actually learn from them and turn them into something positive. And like all traits, we need to learn how to use them well and in a positive way. We should never adapt to evil or injustice, nor should we get used to our blessings to the extent that we take them for granted and fail to derive any happiness from them. And this cycle of reaching for more and more and more, this has become known as the hedonic treadmill. And this term is a psychological term for adaptation. It's the tendency of humans to return quickly to a prior level of happiness after experiencing an elevated one due to a positive event. And because of adaptation, humans endlessly seek pleasures. That's where the hedonic portion comes in, without actually making real emotional progress. And that's where the treadmill comes in. Because in a treadmill, you know, you're moving, you're walking, but you're not actually moving. In other words, the tendency to seek more is an outcome of the fact that what we already have fails to make us happy. In addition, not just the tendency to seek, but the tendency to desire more itself causes a lack of happiness. For when we're focused on getting more, we lose focus on what we already have. And thus we don't have the ability to gain any happiness from it. So it's not only that seeking more makes us not appreciate what we have, but our desire itself diminishes what we are. Our desire for more diminishes the value of what we have. I want to give a little example in my personal life. When I was 15, I was getting my driver's permit, and as most of you know, for a teenager to get their car is like, it's like I'm an adult now. I have freedom, I can go wherever I want. And I remember I was 15, my grandpa had this car he gave to my cousin who lived like an hour and a half away. And I remember him saying, like, oh, you know, if your cousin gets a new car, you can have that car. Like, sure, yeah, just take it. Like, no one will be using it. And I thought, like, wow, if I get that car, I wake up every morning and the days will be brighter, I'll be happier, I'll have a smile on my face, I can go wherever I want, whenever I want. The ultimate freedom. And I remember when I turned 16 and I got my license, my mom took me there, I got my license, I drove my car to the gym for the first time by myself, and it was just like how I thought it'd be, for like a week and a half. And then what happened is that driving became normal, and I'm sure it's normal for lots of you here, probably the majority of you here. Thank God we have the ability to drive wherever we want, and we can go wherever we want, but most of us don't really appreciate it. And fast forward to when I was 17, I got into a car accident. Thank God I was fine, everyone else was fine, the other person's car was fine, but my car had to be in the shop for a month, and only then I recognized the value of that car, even though the value never changed. I really only appreciated the car when it was gone. Do we really need to lose something to be able to appreciate its value? And this tendency of people to reach for more and more, not appreciate what we have, the result is people who have many blessings in their lives, but who are none the happier.
So what's the solution? How can we achieve happiness and experience joy over the things that we already have? How can we appreciate the normal in our day-to-day lives? This next text I'm going to read by the fifth Rebbe of Chabad discusses in Hasidic terminology, human emotions. It's going to talk about the issue we've been discussing and begin a conversation about a solution. When a person pours feelings of love into words, the act of speaking these words feels and intensifies the love. Through speaking about it, the emotional energy radiates with more passion, and the person is aroused with more love and fondness for the beloved. The same applies to all emotions. When they are not expressed through speech, they are reduced until they completely dissipate. When they are expressed verbally, they augment and grow considerably. So this prevents normality from enabling us to take the blessings in our lives for granted. Essentially, what this text is saying is that the less we talk about the good and the positive in our lives, the less we'll feel those happy emotions associated. And even worse, the more we dwell on and verbalize the negative in our lives, the more we'll feel those unhappy feelings associated. Now, this reminded me of something within my own personal life that I'm sure many of you can relate to. And that's bringing attention to or focusing on something bad that happens throughout your day. It could be something small, like a car cutting you off, making you a few minutes later, a dispute with a coworker, or even just not doing so well on a test that you thought you did better on. Now, of course, these aren't the most positive things that could happen throughout your day, but by speaking about them and verbalizing them to others, you'll in turn most likely feel even worse. And it could be the case that a close family member or friend gives you a call right after that car cut you off, and you just really want to verbalize how horrible of a day you're having, and that was the worst thing ever. But by doing so, it'll only make things worse. Instead, you should focus on verbalizing the positive and all the good that's happening throughout your day. And these could be small things, like having the ability to fill up your gas tank or buy yourself a coffee before work. These are things that are normalized maybe in your day-to-day life, so you don't even realize that they're blessings. But if you verbalize them, you'll feel even happier. Because by talking about the good and the positive, those feelings will grow more intensely. And by talking less about the negative, those feelings will eventually dissipate, and you'll no longer feel the unhappy feelings associated. Fortunately, Judaism has a built-in system that forces us to pay close attention to all of the good in our lives. And this is known as Hakar HaTov, or recognizing the positive. It expresses itself within various mitzvot, one of which being the mitzvah of Bikurim. This mitzvah allows us to appreciate the normal in our day-to-day lives. It prevents us from overlooking our blessings. The mitzvah of Bikurim took place when the Jewish people settled in the land of Israel during the biblical times. The Jewish farmer would take his fruits, place those fruits in a basket, and bring that basket to the Holy Temple in Jerusalem. Upon doing so, he would offer a proclamation in which he said, God brought us out from Egypt with a strong hand and with an outstretched arm, with great awe and with miraculous signs and wonders. He brought us to this place, and he gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. Now behold, I have brought the first of the fruit of the ground that you, God, have given me. Now, the average Jewish farmer who brought the first fruits was born in Israel and had reaped many good harvests in prior years. He was used to being able to feed himself and his family. He hadn't suffered being a slave as a result of an exodus. Many of us are like that average Jewish farmer. We've had the ability to provide for our families, or we've been provided for by our families. We have the privilege of having a roof over our heads, our own form of transportation, 3 meals a day. Now, the chances are high that these blessings would go unnoticed because they're normalized in our lives. In regards to both the farmer and us, the farmer has always been able to feed his family, just like many of us have been able to do so. In order to combat this, the Torah commands the Jewish people to provide and express in word and deed the gratitude for all of these positives. Oftentimes, we take things for granted. And this could mean something different to everyone. This could mean taking for granted the fact that we live in America with all the opportunities it has to offer. Being able to practice your Judaism freely and proudly. This wasn't always the case. Our ancestors experienced the Holocaust, pogroms, Spanish Inquisition, and how many of them would really appreciate being able to practice their Judaism freely every single day if given the chance? This could mean taking for granted this current retreat that we're on right now. Look around you. We're at this wonderful hotel with delicious food, fabulous speakers, and where else could you obtain this much knowledge in such a short amount of time? You don't have to go on Amazon and order 50 different books from 50 different authors to receive this much knowledge. You have some of the best speakers in the Jewish world right here at your fingertips. This could mean students taking for granted their Chabad on campus. How many students are going to their Chabad house for free meals, a nice place to stay, friends? After that fifth Friday in a row, are you really appreciating that Shabbat dinner, or has it just become a normalized part of your weekly routine? Does that student have to be graduated back home making their own Shabbat dinner in order to really appreciate that blessing that was right in front of them? Do we have to be back home from the retreat trying to learn on Amazon scrolling to get a book in order to really recognize that blessing that was right in front of us? Do we have to experience those hardships that our ancestors experienced in order to really understand the positive right now? I would hope that none of these things have to happen in order for us to really recognize all of the positives in our daily lives. And what's the result of expressing this gratitude? The next verse continues, and you shall rejoice in all the good that God has given you and your family. The implication seems to be that focusing on and verbalizing the gratitude allowed the Jewish farmer to really appreciate all the things he had in his life. It didn't allow him to adapt to his blessings, and it prevented him from dwelling on the things he lacked and helped him focus more on the things that he had. Now, this is a practice I think we should all take into account. Focusing on everything that's right in front of us, even if it may be normalized in our daily life, and dwelling less on the things we don't have and the bad things going on. And now, although the Holy Temple was destroyed and we no longer have the mitzvah of the first fruits, the soul of this mitzvah has received eternal life in Jewish daily rituals.
Okay, so in the Midrash, the Tanchuma, which is pretty much a running commentary about specific books in the Bible, says, Moses foresaw that the temple would be destroyed and the offering of the first fruits would cease. He therefore ordained that the Jewish people should pray 3 times a day. While some people often think of prayer as a time to really plead and ask for the things that they want, but in actuality, most of Jewish prayer is more utterances of thanks and gratitude. In our prayers, nothing is taken for granted, but rather as granted. And once you're able to change your mindset of taking things for granted into one that sees and is aware of what exactly you've been blessed with, you'll see an almost immediate change in your perspective and in your life. Instead of thinking, ugh, I have to go to work, into, wow, I get the opportunity to go to work and make money for myself to provide for the things that I want. Or for students, instead of, you know, dreading the fact that you have an 8 a.m. class and you have to wake up super early in the morning, to thinking, I get the opportunity to go further myself, further my education, invest in myself, and set myself up for success. Even just making that tiny, minor shift in terminology of what you tell yourself can make such a huge perspective in your life and in your outlook. And just how the Bikurim fruits were harvested from the first fruits of every crop, we also are able to harvest these first seconds of every morning and dedicate a prayer consisting of gratefulness for the gift of life. When we say the words, Modeh ani lefanecha, melech chai v'kayam, shechezarta bi nishmati b'chemla, rabba emunatecha, we are taking the very first moments of our days and opening it with this intentional gratitude of being thankful for the ability to wake up in the morning. Waking up in the morning and having all of our facilities work is not something that should be seen as a normal occurrence. Every time that we wake up, it's a gift given to us from the creator of the entire universe. And honestly, it should be seen as such too. You know, I know for me, when we open up our days with a sign of intentional gratitude after the Modeh Ani, our prayer book then presents a series of blessings that really thanks God for the proper functioning of our bodies, the ability to walk, the ability to talk, and so on and so forth. I know for me, when I open my mornings with this mindset of intentional gratitude and voice my gratitude out loud while putting lots and lots of kavanah or intention into my words, I can see the very tangible differences of the way that I approach various challenges and deal with what the day brings. And when we're able to build this gratitude into our lives, the result will be very similar to the farmer who brought Bikurim. We will find more happiness, because as we've already discussed, when we express an emotion that feeds it, it builds it, and strengthens that even more. And interestingly enough, this has also been backed by research. From the book Gratitude Works, which was written by a psychologist from UC Davis and was published in 2013, the authors conducted a study that examined the physical and psychological effects of incorporating daily gratitude practices in college students' daily lives. So it seems pretty, you know, applicable for a lot of us here. In this study, the authors gathered various college students and split them up into three random groups. In our first group, this was the gratitude condition. And in this group, the students had to briefly describe five things that they were grateful for that happened to them that week. In our second group, this was the hassles condition. And in this condition, the students had to describe five relatively minor inconveniences that happened to them. This could be dealing with the rising prices of gas, doing laundry, or even misplacing one's wallet. And then in our last and final group, this was the events condition. And in this condition, the students had to briefly describe five events that affected them in one way or another that week. Didn't have to be necessarily good or bad. So basically, these students completed these tasks, as well as a variety of other measures of health and happiness, once a week for 10 consecutive weeks. And let me tell you, the results were quite incredible. The students in the optimistic or in the gratitude condition reported that they felt so much better about their lives as a whole and were more optimistic about their futures than both of the students in the hassles and the events condition. To kind of put this into numbers, the students in the gratitude condition were a full 25% happier than the other students. 25%. Those in the gratitude condition also reported that they had fewer health complaints and even spent more time exercising and taking care of themselves. So this is really just to show that something as simple as counting your blessings once a week can result in such significant emotional and health benefits. However, we also need to stress a crucial point of gratitude in the Jewish tradition. Hakarat HaTov isn't just making a quick mental note to yourself about the things that are going right in your life. It's also not just mentally counting your blessings. Rather, it's a daily conversation with God, and obviously, when appropriate, with other people too, about the things that you're grateful for, where we talk about our sense of gratitude for the things that he has given us and for his underlying care and love that motivated that giving. I want you all to take a moment and imagine meeting your role model, okay? And let's just say they sign something and give it to you. How would you feel? That object would never lose its assigned value. It would never become normal. It would never become any less special, right? Now, every morning that we wake up, we are given the priceless gift of getting to live another day and making a positive difference in this world from the biggest celebrity of all, our ruler, the creator of the entire universe, Hashem. In other words, Jewish gratitude always has an address. The verse of Bikurim does not say, "You shall rejoice in all the good that you and your family have." It says, "You shall rejoice in all the good that God has given you and your family." This type of gratitude inspires so much more joy and happiness than just making a quick mental note. When people understand that God loves us and cares for us and truly only wants what's best for us, this is an even greater source of happiness than the happiness that you can derive from a particularly good circumstance in life. To kind of make this point a little bit more, we have two hypothetical scenarios that we're going to take a quick look at. In our first scenario, we have Sarah. And as Sarah is walking down the hallway at school, she noticed a chocolate bar on the floor. After asking around, she can't find the owner, and the secretary tells her to keep it. And then in our second scenario, we have Rachel. And as Rachel was opening up her backpack, surprise! One of her friends snuck a chocolate bar into her bag with a little note saying, "Happy birthday." All else pretty much being equal, whose good fortune will bring more happiness? Quite obviously, yeah, Rachel will be much happier. I mean, they both got a bar of chocolate, but Rachel got so much more. Not only did she get a fun little treat, she also got the priceless feeling of being loved, cared for, connected, and she knew that someone was thinking about her. I mean, who doesn't appreciate a good morning message or receiving a call on your birthday? It makes us feel appreciated and loved and thought about. I want to share a quick story with everyone, with you all. This past year, I was interning at the hospital by my house, and I had the privilege to sit and talk and with the patients and also help the doctors and nurses with various care tasks. And I remember this one Friday morning in September, I was really excited to go. I was like, I'm always so pumped to see what I can learn and help out. And so I started making my rounds. As I entered this older woman's room, I struck up a conversation with her and her daughter who was there accompanying her. Turns out, we're both Jewish. Her son is friends with some of my closest friends. And she also knows my rabbi in Rabbitson. And since it was Shishi or Friday, they shared with me that they were going to have to spend Shabbat at the hospital with their mother. I asked them if there was anything I could bring for them, just, you know, from the hospital or from my Chabad house, just, you know, something to help them. The only thing they said, they gave me a pair of Shabbat candles and told me if I could light for their mother or for the grandmother. I said, of course, you know, obviously. And I also shared with them that I was going to spend Shabbat at my Chabad house that weekend. I took those candles, I put them in my pocket, and I left the room. As I was leaving, one of the other nurses asked me if I could bring a pitcher of ice cold water to the room, to the patient who just happened to be next door. I said, yeah, of course. So, you know, I took I took this picture, and when I brought them the water, I heard the family speaking Hebrew. And turns out the patient didn't want ice water. So as I turned away to go bring a room temp pitcher, I heard the son ask her, "Did you see her name? Do you think she's Jewish or Israeli even?" And when I walked back in, they asked me if I was Jewish and if I spoke Hebrew, and I said yes. And so we're all just there, you know, talking, just everyone's just, you know, talking and sharing and for a little bit. And as I was leaving, I heard the absolute desperation in the mother's voice when she shared that she didn't know how they were going to keep, you know, lighting Shabbat candles at the hospital that weekend because they couldn't leave the sick father alone. I then remembered I had a pair of Shabbat candles in my pocket that they would be able to light there, right there in the hospital. I gave them the candles, and honestly, just the look in that mother's face was, she was so overjoyed that they would be able to continue doing this mitzvah even in the hospital, and they wouldn't have to leave their sick family member alone. Just for me, I was honestly so overjoyed that I could help this family continue candle lighting without leaving that family member alone. And this entire interaction really just reminded me about how Rachel felt loved and connected from receiving something personal from her friends. Hashem chose me to be the vessel of making sure that these two families felt loved, connected, and cared for. And the same is very true for all of us here. You know, thank God all of us have so many blessings in our life that brings us lots of joy, right? And it's also true that the Creator is looking out for us, caring for us, loving us, and is protecting us and is providing for us. A good friend of mine always says, rejection is God's protection. As in, if something we wanted doesn't work out, there's a reason, and God is protecting us from that. We may not comprehend the reasoning for this rejection, but we need to have complete faith that God did it for a good reason. And when we're able to build this sort of mentality of, you know, when we're able to build this mentality of intentional gratitude and shift our focus from what we have or what we don't have to being grateful for all the gifts that we've been given while voicing our appreciation, our lives will become more purposeful, and the mundane occurrences, or, you know, normal occurrences, will become the cherished gifts that they are truly meant to be. And once we realize that our Creator is the one who is truly protecting us, we are able to expand our capacity for joy by tenfold.
Now that we have the framework and those thought patterns we were thinking about earlier, those thought processes, how do we apply this practically? It's easy to say, okay, something bad happened, switch your brain off and think about something good. It's super easy. Sometimes it's extremely difficult, and we need to be able to get that perspective. So now let's visit back that small little mental activity we did in the beginning of the class. And that is the key to being able to do this, to be able to switch that mindset, to be able to give yourself perspective. I'm going to give a quick little story. We have 10 minutes left. Don't worry, it's not 10 minutes long. So on my college campus, you know, as most of you know, like, college parking spots are extremely expensive, and, you know, driving on campus is always a pain, and then walking around. So on my campus, I bought an electric skateboard. I have my little remote. I zoom wherever I want to go. It goes really fast, like 24 miles an hour. It's honestly like how I survive. Like, I'm able to schedule classes like 5 minutes apart to get across like ASU's campus, which most people are like, oh, I can't take that class. I don't have enough time to get there. Anyways, the point is that I use the skateboard to get from my house to campus, to my lab, to class, back to Chabad, back to my house, around, to the 7-Eleven next to my house, everything. And one day, I was skateboarding to my physics class like I've done many times, to my physics lab, and I go, I put my skateboard in the rack, lock it up with my lock like I do every single time, and I go upstairs, do my lab, it was about an hour long, I come down, and I look at the rack, and I'm like, where's my skateboard? And I'm like, wait, there's like four racks along like the wall. Maybe I like just put it in a different rack. So I like go down. I look. It's nothing, nothing, nothing. All the racks in like a solid like 300-foot vicinity, like they were nowhere to be found. And let me remind you, this skateboard is like multiple hundreds of dollars. And I was just feeling in my chest, like I was like, oh no, like what's happening? Like I started to feel panic and this like tightness in my chest. Like I felt like I was like my body was about to like jump out of my skin because like I felt like so like panicky. And then I remember thinking like, I do not like how this feels at all. And this feeling is not gonna help me in any way at all. And I remember I pulled out my list, and actually the crazy thing was I did a class with this list activity like 7 days before or something. And I pull out my list and I look at it. And I'm like, what's the most important things in my life? Let's see, we have health, family, friends, my family's health, my friend's health. Oh, I'm already at five. I keep going down, and then there's my skateboard. And I'm like, oh, like, I mean, like, come on. Like, thank God I'm healthy. Thank God I have no illness and whatever. Thank God I have good relationships. I have a great family. I have great friends. My skateboard was stolen. I got to pay another couple hundred dollars. Like, it's replaceable. And even if something isn't replaceable, we still know from this class, just by looking at that list, that everything Hashem does is for us and for our benefit. And so that's how we apply this practically. When something bad happens to you in life, that's really what causes your happiness to diminish. But the way to avoid that is to use these thought processes that we talk about, to use this list in your brain. Think about, oh, this happened, it's ruining my day. And you think about, you know, where it is in your list, and it'll really put things into perspective. So right now, I just want to take a second to thank JLI, Sinai Scholars, and all of you guys for attending today. I also want to thank Noah and Brenna for working so hard. For preparing this class, they spent hours and hours and hours preparing. I'm not exaggerating. We all did. And I also want to thank my parents for being here. Thank you guys for supporting me. And all my friends, the AS Jews and the honorary AS Jews, the CSUNners, you know, everyone. So now, I think we have about like five-ish minutes. So we're going to open it up to a Q&A. If you have any questions, like feel free to raise your hand. I can call. You can ask anything about their experience as teachers, anything about the program itself. And yeah, so I guess we'll go for questions now. We have 5 minutes. And we also have other questions that are pre-written just in case no one doesn't want to. Yeah, go ahead, please.
Is the program expanding, and if so, how does that happen? You wanted to bring that.
So the program actually, it is expanding. As I, in the beginning, I was talking about how this program, it's just a pilot semester. So we had, I think, about 11 applicants. And seven of them taught on their campus at least one class. And that was kind of like the start. So now this year, the whole idea is you take Sinai Scholars, you go to the retreat, and then what do you do after that? You just like, okay, I'm done? No, you have to put what you learned into action. You have to learn Aleph, and you have to share Aleph. You came to the retreat, you learned. Now you share. So what we're gonna do this next coming year is my goal when continuing this program is to implement it in more campuses, to advertise it more here. Because last year, it wasn't really advertised at the retreat. The program really was made official in December. So it was very limited to who really like knew about it and who was willing to put in the time and the effort. But with hopes, my goal is for this next year to at least triple our numbers.
Yeah!
Ariel? So this question is applicable to all of us. So, because I've just been talking for all, I'll let these two go first.
So for me, I had a few leadership roles on campus, and I also teach at the temple by my school. So kind of stepping into like a teacher role was fun. I kind of took everything that I was learning and I was able to kind of spin it in a way that was unique to my own teaching style and that I knew that my friends would be kind of more receptive and open to because, you know, learning on your own time, it's a little bit more difficult to kind of push yourself to do it. So I knew my friends were making this effort. I was going to make it fun for us and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I honestly really loved kind of transitioning into that role of getting to share my knowledge with my friends, especially seeing like the effects of it and seeing how, for me personally, how I took all of this and apply it every day into my life and how my friends have taken it and applied it into their life. So I hope that was a good answer.
Honestly, like, I was really nervous at first to teach the class because I was like, are my students, like, at my school gonna think that what I'm saying is, like, even real? But obviously, like, it turned out really well, and they were, like, really receptive to it and, like, really good feedback. I definitely think, like, teaching a class kind of allows you to, like, learn it on, like, a different level because when you're learning something when someone else is teaching it, of course you're listening, but when you have to teach it, like, you have to really, really understand what you're saying. So going over it required me to really learn more, and I prepared a lot for it, like speaking with my rabbi and like just learning more about the topic, really. So, yeah.
So really the idea here that's emphasized throughout the retreat is that like anyone can share knowledge. Like, learn all of share all of stems from the fact that if you know only one letter, you can share that one letter. So really, there is no qualification except for having a passion to do so and having the willpower and having the determination to put in the work that you need to do. But practically speaking, if a student wants to teach it, now because it's official, we'll be sending out, you know, applications to all the shluchim. They can discuss with their rabbis and rabbitsons what's the best course of action to be able to actually teach on their campus. And what goes into it. You know, it's not just saying like, oh, I'll teach it. It's, you have to advertise, you have to prepare the lesson, you have to, you know, convince students to take time out of their week. Like, teaching your friends is like great, but like imagine like in the middle of the week, like to get students to even come to an event where there's free food is extremely difficult. Like, I literally say, come, free food, and then when they come, I try to convince them to stay for another reason, because Rabbi Shmuel is awesome. But to getting people there is extremely difficult. And you have to wait to kind of make it applicable to them, sell it to them. Like for my classes, I go and buy out all of Trader Joe's. Thank God Rabbi is a really generous sponsor. So I buy out all of Trader Joe's and bring my friends, like, hey, there's snacks, and you might learn something new. And that's really what it's about is, you know, it'll be accessible to all students of all levels. And this idea is not just applicable to students, it's applicable to everyone, to everyone here. You know, even if you're not on a campus, you as a Jew and as a proud Jew have a responsibility to share that passion and to share your knowledge with the people around you. Now, you don't have to force people to do anything, but the Rebbe says that the best way to teach is to be a dugma chaya, which is to be a living example. And so that's everyone's responsibility, not just the students. Sure. That's a packed one. Okay. Okay. Which one of you would like to? Okay. Okay. Yeah. No. Go ahead.
If I look at Zahner too long, I'll cry too. But basically, I gotten really more involved with Chabad about 2 years ago at kickoff, and at first I was super intimidated, but I started coming and my best friends came and we all just, you know, really created a mishpacha, and Sandra and Mendy and Rabbi and Razel really like enforced that. And we all, you know, hang out till like 2, 3, 4 in the morning all the time. But I think the biggest thing that I really got out of Chabad of Sisson especially is like, we always say no matter where you go, you can always come back home. And it doesn't matter how far you go or where you go, you always have a place to come back to. And I'm moving cross-country next week and leaving Sandra and, you know, all my Chabad of Sisson family is probably one of the more difficult things I have to do. And I know that I can always come back. I always have a place with them, no matter how much time goes by.
First of all, that's my dad, and I knew he was going to ask a question. That was definitely, I knew that was coming. So thank you guys for coming, my parents. But that question, I don't want to go too in-depth about it because you guys will hear that later, a different time. But Chabad for me was like very, very impactful, and it really changed my college experience. I didn't get involved until the end of my fourth year, and so it really, like, my Revitson's right here, Mickey. But just having a place to go whenever I wanted, if I like was homesick, I like had a second home once I got to school. And I always had like good kosher food.
All right, thank you guys so much for coming. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out, speak to any of us. We're here until Sunday, just like most of you, I think. So now for the Sinai Scholars here, we have group session now, so head to your spots. And everyone else, thanks for coming.
Please visit myjli.com to learn more about JLI's multiple educational offerings.